My guest is an eminent English academic, though he spent about 10 years at Columbia University in this country. David Cannadine is the author of many important works, an historian, and is now the author of the book only recently published, In Churchill's Shadow, Confronting the Past in Modern Britain. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
I want to establish you're here because I want to start instantly with a quotation, if I can get my hands on it, but then I may not be able to. I had a very perfect quotation with which to begin. It was from George Orwell, and the rapid noise of papers shuffling suggests that I'm searching for it, but will I find it? I have. England is the most class-ridden country under the sun. It is a land of snobbery and privilege, ruled largely by the old and silly. But in any calculation about it, one has got to take into account its emotional unity, the tendency of nearly all its inhabitants to feel alike and to act together in moments of supreme crisis. Was he onto something?
Well, of course, Orwell wrote that in the Second World War and was talking about the way that the British, rather to his surprise, and I think on the whole to his delight, had apparently united behind Churchill against Hitler. And I think to the extent that that's what he was saying, he was onto something and he got it right. The phrase about it being the most class-ridden society under the sun is often quoted. Of course, I don't know how you could prove that it were true. I mean, I don't know much about class in France or class in Vienna or even class in this country, where the fact that people don't talk about it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I think what one can say is that Orwell himself was obsessed with class. He was, after all, an old Etonian who went down and out in Paris and London and was obsessed with the different gradations of society that he knew about and saw and was very guilty about his own position. So Orwell himself thought about class all the time. Whether it's true that all British people did the same thing, I think, is probably less true.
The central figure in this book of yours, and I should say it is really a collection of occasional essays, but they do weave together and fit together very nicely, and the main figure is Churchill.
That's right. I mean, he's partly the main figure because I always find him enormously interesting to write about, so I've written quite a lot about him.
And didn't Churchill himself, well, don't you rather say in this book, in one of the essays, that Churchill himself was very aware of and completely in favor of the class rigidity of the England that he inherited?
Yes, Churchill was a child of the late Victorian era. He was the grandson of a duke. I think there's a sense in which his preferred social order was where everybody, as it were, knew their place, and that in that social order he ranked fairly high. But he also did believe in a kind of paternal, old-fashioned way.
The two go together, don't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Noblesse oblige.
Yeah, he did believe that the lot of the working class ought to be better than it was, and of course, as a reforming liberal minister in the 1900s, he put through a lot of legislation to improve their lot.
Lots of people who know him in his mythic form don't know that in his long, very long political career, in fact, he crossed the aisle more than once.
He was a very controversial figure, and the kind of apotheosized great man of post-1940 is, as you say, a kind of late invention, really. But Churchill went into Parliament, as befitted a man of his background, as a Conservative. He then crossed the floor and became a Liberal, coincidentally at just the point when the Conservatives were going out of power and the Liberals were coming into power. And then after the First World War, he ceased to be a Liberal and became a Conservative again. So, as he said, he not only ratted, but he re-ratted. And that's very unusual, and he was lucky to survive.
The French, as you know, say the more it changes, the more it is the same. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. But I've heard a wise person say, no, they've got it wrong. What they really know is plus ça change, plus ça change. The more that is, change is the rule of history, and you never go back again. Things don't reassert themselves. The mix is always a new one. Technology pushes forward. New external challenges pushes you forward into disorder or into some higher integration of your national civilization. But things always change. And this book, the theme in your book really is that England changed tremendously over the last 50 years. And you all still live, quote, in Churchill's shadow. He, the great and last prophet of the glory of empire.
I think that's right. The way the British do this is that they like to think that external trappings and facades don't change, but that behind that lots of things do change, and the external trappings and facades that don't change are called traditions, and the British talk about those a lot, but actually behind that or underneath that an awful lot is constantly evolving, and that seems to be the way things operate in Britain. I mean, Britain is historically, by European standards, quite an odd country in the 19th and 20th century, in that it's a country with no invasion, no revolution, no monarchy thrown out, no military defeat in a large-scale war. That distinguishes it from France, Germany, Russia, Spain, whatever country you want. And so there is a sense in which Britain's history, although it's in many ways about change, isn't about the sort of wrenching, disruptive, revolutionary changes that have characterized France or Germany or Russia or Italy.
Let us get a touch of Churchill in the night. He's going to be one of our main subjects tonight. And, of course, you have a whole chapter on his oratory.
I do indeed.
We are about to hear some Churchillian oratory.
Good.
This is, in fact, the speech of May 13th, 1940. I believe it's a radio speech rather than a parliamentary speech. It's the blood, toil, tears, and sweat speech. You want to say a word about it?
Yes, well, it must be recorded later because, of course, this was the speech that he gave in Parliament having just been invited to form a government. And he delivered it in Parliament and it wasn't broadcast. Ah. So I think he must have re-recorded it later.
He did do some of that.
Yes, he did do some of
that.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
What about the challenge of the speech and the way in which he met the challenge?
Well, by Churchill standards, this is a rather interesting speech because it's very short. It's the first statement he makes as Prime Minister. And what he wanted to do here was to say, we're going to survive, we're going to cope, we must all join together. But as he says here, he hasn't got much to offer. Things don't look very good. Mm. All that's available is blood, toil, tears and sweat. And that's what he proposes to provide. But these are quite unusual Churchillian words because they're very, very short. And on the whole, we tend to think of him using lots of long words. But here, they're short words in a short speech. I think one contemporary said, Winston makes a very fine statement, short and to the point. And short and to the point is not what we usually think of with Churchill. So in that sense, it's quite a rare item.
Here's an excerpt.
In this crisis, I hope I may be pardoned if I do not address the House at any length today. I hope that any of my friends and colleagues or former colleagues who are affected by the political reconstruction will make all allowances for any lack of ceremony with which it has been necessary to act. I would say to the House, as I said to those who have joined the government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might, with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory, however long and hard the road may be, for without victory there is no survival. Let that be realized. No survival for the British Empire. No survival for all that the British Empire stood for. No survival for the urge and impulse of the ages that mankind will move forward towards its goal. But I take up my task with buoyancy and hope. I feel sure that our cause will not be suffered to fail among men. At this time, I feel entitled to claim the aid of all. And I say, come then, let us go forward together with our united strength.
By golly, I'll sign right now.
Well, they don't make him like that anymore. It's a very interesting speech because it's short, as he himself says. It's interesting because, although short, it does show some of the famous Churchillian stylistic tricks and preferences.
Oh, it's quite grandiloquent, even
it's quite grandiloquent.
Yes.
And, of course, it's important to remember that it was quite a tricky speech to give because when Churchill became Prime Minister, most people actually didn't want Churchill to be Prime Minister at all. They wanted the Earl of Halifax. And so one of Churchill's problems, as if Hitler isn't a big enough problem enough, is that domestically he has a very weak power base in the British Parliament in terms of the support that he gets from the Conservative Party. So he's actually fighting to some degree for his own political survival in Westminster, even as Britain is fighting for its own national survival against Hitler. And the speech is as much about that, that's to say, telling people that he's going to be in power and he's going to stay around, as it is telling that to Hitler.
The historian John Lucas did a book a few years ago titled 6 Days in May, was it? Was it that May,
That's
1940,
right.
In which he says that Halifax led a faction who really wanted, essentially, to make peace with Hitler on Hitler's terms.
Yes, there's a big debate which rages throughout the summer of 1940, after Churchill has become Prime Minister, as to whether, in fact, peace should be made with Hitler. Hitler puts out peace feelers, and so do various members of the government, I think unknown to Churchill. And there's a very controversial set of debates in the cabinet, which Churchill never mentions in his History of the Second World War, I should add. And Churchill only just wins on that.
So in this speech, he's probably speaking to Halifax and his opponents on the crucial policy issue.
That's right. Oh, yes. This is as much addressed to his colleagues and, in some sense, his enemies in Parliament as it is to the British people outside and beyond.
You write so interestingly about Churchill in two of the essays, one on Churchill in relation to the monarchy and the whole British tradition, and two, Churchill as an orator. It's hard to put him in a capsule characterization. All the same, put him in a capsule characterization. What's the key to his genius?
Well, the key to Churchill is that he was a very complicated man, and that Churchill at his best was a remarkable figure of undeniable genius. Churchill at his worst was a much less admirable figure, vulgar, bullying, wayward in judgment, drinking too much alcohol. And that's the side of Churchill that most people before 1940 spent most of their time worrying about. And for many people, that's another reason they don't want him to be Prime Minister in 1940. It's bad enough fighting Hitler. The thought of Churchill fighting Hitler is a terrible prospect for many people, and the fact that it all comes good in 1940 is a big surprise. So Churchill was this curious combination of a man who was extraordinary and great and wonderful in one way, but in other ways unreliable, not untrustworthy, but certainly wayward. Everything about Churchill was on a larger-than-life scale. F.E. Smith, one of his friends, once said, "When Winston's right, it's wonderful, but when he's bad, my God, it's dreadful." And I think there is a lot of truth in that. And much of the interest of Churchill, in Churchill as a historical figure, as I see it, is in following through both the greatness of Churchill, which I think was wonderful and ultimately won out, and, as it were, the lesser side of Churchill, which his contemporaries knew very well, but which after 1940 tended to be forgotten.
Is he a great and distinctively significant master of the oratorical art, or rather, would all the men of his generation and his class have had essentially the same skills?
If you wanted to get ahead in public life in Churchill's time — Churchill was born in 1875, so was coming into public life at the turn of the 20th century — if at that stage you wanted to go into public life, it was still thought at that time that you should prepare yourself for public life by, among other things, learning to speak in public. A huge amount of British business, in a way, was transacted by the spoken word, especially, of course, in Parliament, where the standards of debates were amazingly high, largely because the majority of people, unlike Churchill, had gone to Oxford or Cambridge universities, and they'd learned how to debate at the Oxford and Cambridge unions, which were kind of parliaments of young men training themselves to be orators. Churchill suffers from the disadvantage that he does not go to Oxford or Cambridge and has to train himself to be an orator.
He went to Sandhurst.
He went to Sandhurst.
The British Military Academy.
That's right. He went to Harrow Public School.
Was a rather poor student there, as I remember.
He wasn't very good. No, he wasn't very good. But he wanted to become a public figure. He wanted to go into politics. So he made himself become an orator, and he was a self-taught orator. And because I think, in a sense, he had so much catching up to do, he actually ended up being rather better at it than most of his contemporaries. Though, again, he only became really renowned as an orator in 1940, although everybody knew before that it was great stuff. It somehow never caught the imagination in the way that, of course, in 1940 it finally and magnificently did.
He was involved in a situation which may mark the beginning of the dissolution of the British Empire, or rather, the beginning of the penetration of British self-confidence. What I have in mind — you can choose all sorts of things, obviously, but this one is figural and is significant — the abdication of Edward VIII from the British throne. And he, Churchill, was behind the scenes. We'll talk about that more. We'll hear Edward VIII giving his abdication speech. All of that will follow right after we pause for these words. ¶¶ music that we hear behind us is, of course, an important imperial symbol or an important representation of the imperial spirit. What is it?
Well, it's Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance number one, the first of a set of marches that Elgar wrote in the early 1900s. The quotation, of course, as I'm sure everybody knows, is from Othello, The Pride, Pomp and Circumstance of Glorious War. And, of course, that first Pomp and Circumstance march contains a bit later the big tune to which the words Land of Hope and Glory were later set by A.C. Benson. And, of course, it includes the phrase, Wider still and wider shall thy bounds be set, God who made thee mighty, make thee mightier yet. A fairly extravagant statement of imperial confidence, and that, of course,
the world was still being covered with pink.
It was still being covered with pink, and God was an Englishman, and Churchill was growing up, and that for him was the best of all possible worlds.
What was the peak of the extension or the extent of the British Empire?
It's something that actually most people don't know, but the British Empire was at its greatest extent just after the First World War, because, of course, it acquired. In the First World War, these things that were called League of Nations mandates, that's to say parts of the dismembered Turkish and German empires that were then administered by various bits of the victorious powers, mainly France and Britain. And so Britain got Jordan and Iraq and Palestine. And it from the Turks, and it got German East Africa and German Southwest Africa from the Germans, and it got various bits of Pacific Islands as well. And those added on to what the British had already acquired, as it were, for themselves, meant that just after the First World War, the British Empire was at its greatest extent, and you could travel all the way from Cairo to Cape Town through Africa and never leave British territory.
And what was the cost of empire in terms of life? Did the thin red line often get penetrated? Did many British soldiers get killed, off in Africa, off in Asia, wherever they were confronting hostile local forces?
Well, the cost of empire is one of these issues that have kept historians in business since the empire was, and will keep them in business for as long as there are historians to debate it, I think. It's certainly true that, as Kipling said, there was this thing called the white man's burden, that British people, men and women, in fact, went out, often, I think, genuinely selflessly to govern and administer the empire, to teach, to be missionaries, to be doctors. And many of them died of diseases. If you go to the cemeteries in Calcutta or in Kingston, Jamaica, you'll see all these British people who died very young. And in that sense, the cost was high. Of course, there were other people who took the view that the cost was high in terms of the Irish potato famine or whatever it might be that Britain had in some sense brought about because of empire. So it's a tricky business to be clear about in terms of any final calculation.
It is true, the rationale, not only in Britain, but on the part of other European countries also, was to bring civilization. In Kipling's words from that very same source, it was to bring civilization to lesser breeds without the law.
That's right. That was what they thought they were doing. And
at the same time, the French are talking about la mission civilisatrice.
That's right.
Their mission is to civilize.
That's right. The French, of course, thought the thing to do was to make all these people into Frenchmen. The British never either aspired to or believed that they could ever do that. But certainly the British did believe that one of their jobs was to bring a proper water supply, to bring railways, to bring universities, to produce for people elsewhere in the world, as they saw it, the undeniable benefits of Western education. What I think they never quite foresaw was that if you educated large numbers of people in the empire, they would then turn these weapons against the people who had brought them, that's to say the British, and demand their own independence.
Do you agree with the kind of journalistic judgment I offered a few minutes ago, that a visible moment in which one hears the British Empire beginning to come apart is the crisis over Mrs. Windsor and then the resignation of Edward VIII?
Well, I think there's a whole set of symbolic episodes in the 1920s and 30s. The period when the British Empire, to go back to where we were, is at its greatest extent, was very, very short because, of course, in the early 20s, Egypt becomes almost independent, Southern Ireland becomes independent, and Gandhi starts producing noises off, as it were, in India. Which worries Churchill a lot, of course, and along with many others. And so there is a sense by the 1930s that the enterprise is not quite as formidably grounded as it was. And in that context, the fact that here is this playboy, selfish man, Edward VIII, who believes that true love with, as some many people think, this ghastly American adventuress, Mrs. Simpson, is the way the King of England ought to behave, is indeed for many people further much regretted corroboration of the view that the rot has set in and that the country's on the skids. And of course, what was often said to Edward VIII in the aftermath of the abdication was that many people had made the ultimate sacrifice on the grounds of patriotic duty in the First World War. All he was being asked to do was to get rid of Mrs. Simpson, but he put love and self-gratification before duty and kingship, and many people couldn't forgive that and saw that as a sign that Britain was on the skids.
But the central figure in your book and in our conversation, namely Churchill, in fact is assisting Edward in going forward to the abdication itself.
That's right. This is one of the episodes that was held against Churchill, sign that Churchill had bad judgment, that he supported Edward VIII's position over Mrs. Simpson. I'm not quite sure, I don't think anybody ever was really, why Churchill did this. It's partly, of course, that it was a way of embarrassing the national government under Baldwin, and that Churchill wasn't getting
Baldwin,
well with
him. The then Prime Minister, was extremely and visibly and publicly opposed to Mrs. Simpson.
That's right. Baldwin passionately believed in the notion of public duty and thought that the King was behaving very badly, and fervently hoped that the King would give Mrs. Simpson up and that everything would carry on as normal.
We have the abdication speech itself. We'll hear it in a moment, or a portion of it. What's Churchill's role in the actual preparation of that speech?
It's supposed to be the case, I'm not sure anybody's ever proved this, but that Churchill did have a hand in the drafting of this speech. And there certainly are some cadences and choices of words that are familiar. And certainly Edward VIII never had a reputation as the sort of wordsmith you would have had to have been to have produced this marvellously eloquent and slightly sentimental speech.
So let's listen for the Churchillian cadences.
At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own. I have never wanted to withhold anything. But until now, it has not been constitutionally possible for me to speak. A few hours ago, I discharged my last duty as King and Emperor. And now that I have been succeeded by my brother, the Duke of York, my first words must be to declare my allegiance to him. This I do with all my heart. You all know the reasons which have impelled me to renounce the throne. But I want you to understand that in making up my mind, I did not forget the country or the empire, which, as Prince of Wales and lately as King, I have for 25 years tried to serve. But you must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as King as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love. And I want you to know that the decision I have made has been mine and mine alone.
I see you, David Cannadine, if not chuckling, at least smiling with a certain bemused amusement.
Well, I suppose the bemused and amused thought that was going through my mind was that one could almost imagine Churchill declaiming that. It's not exactly blood, toil, tears and sweat, but one could imagine him saying all that. And quite a few of those phrases are inimitably Churchillian in their cadences, I thought. I jotted down here, dispatched my last duty as King and Emperor. And that's the notion of King and Emperor is certainly a phrase that one could imagine Churchill rather liking. And the way some of the other sentences are constructed are certainly not, I think, the way left to himself that Edward VIII would have constructed them.
Of course, looking at Edward, one thinks of his niece. And one thinks of the royals as they are now. Mm. One thinks of the royal follies that have been going on for the last 20 years or so. Is the monarchy necessarily in decline? Is it becoming an irrelevant vaudeville? Or is it still significant in somehow defining the nature of the continuing English or British civilization?
It's a very good question, that, and it's a very difficult one to answer even in the time we've got available here. One way of thinking about it, of course, is that the royals are no sillier now than they were at the time of Edward VIII. It's just that the newspapers know a lot more about how silly they are, and so it's all in the public domain in a way that in an earlier time it wasn't. Although, of course, if one goes back far enough to the late 18th and early 19th century, the time of Gilray and Rowlandson and the Prince Regent, of course, it was all in the public domain then. So it may be just that monarchy, there's a pendulum which swings back and forth between probity and decency and public virtue and self-indulgence and silliness and frivolity, and the pendulum is swinging fairly rapidly at the moment, and maybe it'll swing back again in the future. Who knows? People often say when the latest crisis comes along, this must be the end of the House of Windsor. That was true with Charles's divorce, it was true with Diana's death, it was true with the Queen Mother's death, it was true with the revelations about the Princess of Wales's butler. But I think that's really journalistic hyperbole. If you ask what it would take to get rid of the British monarchy, as far as I know, there would have to be parliamentary legislation getting rid of it. Well, that's not going to happen. The crowds would have to storm Buckingham Palace and drag its occupants off to the guillotine. I don't think that's in prospect at the moment. Or the Queen would have to say, we've had enough, I'm retiring to Sandringham to breed corgis. And that's not going to happen. So I think it's going to stay around simply because the process of getting rid of it doesn't seem likely to be one that's launched. But I think that there is a problem for it, that it did epitomise a certain sort of moral probity. It did epitomise a certain sort of imperial grandeur. Well, the empire's gone, so you can't do that anymore. And the moral probity has gone in a younger generation, so it can't do that anymore. And I think that the problem is that there is a need for it to find a new sense of purpose and direction among a younger generation. I suppose that could be what Prince Charles is looking for, but I don't think they've found it yet. And that, I think, is a problem for them.
A unifying theme in your book is that all the characters that you deal with, and it isn't just Churchill, you deal with Churchill, you deal with Stanley Baldwin, you deal with Francis Brett Young, a now-forgotten novelist, you deal with the British historian G.M. Trevelyan, with Noel Coward, of all people, and with Ian Fleming, the inventor of the James Bond series. And you have all of them in some relation to the lost or the diminished empire and its values.
That's right. I mean, to the extent that there is a theme which ties all these together, it's partly that for people in the second half of the 20th century, and Coward and Fleming sort of fit into that, there was a sense that they felt that the Britain they were living through, the world of the welfare state in particular, the 1950s and 60s, was a much lesser world than the stern, great world that had been exemplified and had, as it seemed, its last fling under Churchill. So that's the sense of in Churchill's shadow. But there was also a sense for Churchill that he felt himself to be in the shadow of the Victorians. Mm-hmm. He was a child of the Victorian era when he believed everything was for the best in the best of all possible worlds and Britain ran the show. And he saw his job, especially in the Second World War, but before that, to preserve what he regarded as British greatness, the British Empire, which he thought was good for the world. And, of course, the Second World War was really, in one way, all about that. But Churchill came to feel by the end of his life that he'd lived in vain, that he hadn't succeeded in doing that.
Before we leave Churchill in the war and go to him after the war, one other famous Churchillian speech, and this is the one of June 4th, 1940. That's the one, I guess, right after the fall of France.
That's right.
And he's conveying that news to the British public. We'll let him speak for himself, as he did most forcibly on that occasion.
We are told, sir, that Herr Hitler has a plan for invading the British Isles. This has often been thought of before. When Napoleon lay at Boulogne for a year with his flat-bottomed boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, there are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British Expeditionary Force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary, for years, if necessary, alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
I had that a little wrong when I said that this is after the fall of France. Dunkirk has been evacuated, and France is about to fall, but the Nazis don't march into Paris until about the 15th of June.
That's right. This is the speech after the Dunkirk evacuation.
Right.
It has the famous phrase in it, "We must be very careful not to assign to this deliverance the attributes of a victory. Wars are not won by evacuations." And it's the speech after that. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's another great speech that comes after the fall of France 2 weeks later.
There's an anecdote that after he finished that speech, he goes on to say, "We will fight them with, what was it, with bottles or
if
whatever.
Necessary, we'll bash them on the heads with empty bottles."
Yes,
that's right. Yeah.
It was a desperate moment. You remarked to me while we were hearing it that when he talks about the absolute resolve of the monarchy and so on, that wasn't really the case.
No, when he says every man of the cabinet and government are resolved to fight on, that really was a description of how he would have liked things to be, but
yeah,
not how they were. There was at exactly that point a furious debate raging as to whether, in fact, Britain ought not to make peace with Germany.
It leads you to the thing I love to plague historians with, so I'll plague you with it, namely a counterfactual. You do those easily by getting somebody important in history out of history at an earlier point.
Mm.
There was a time, and with Churchill it's commonly done with regard to that accident he had when crossing the street in New York, and he was knocked over by a cab, I
think.
That's
right, yeah.
And he was in bad shape.
Yes, he was.
If he had died at that point, Hitler would still have arisen, the war might very well still have occurred, or would England have yielded at the very beginning so that they wouldn't have confronted a war, they would have merely become a vassal state to Hitler's Germany?
It's hard to know. I think had Churchill been killed when he looked the wrong way in New York, because of course the traffic's on the opposite side of the road in Britain and so was run into, had Churchill been killed instead of just injured in the early 30s in New York, I think Chamberlain would still have gone to war with Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Chamberlain didn't go to war with Hitler because Churchill told him to. Chamberlain went to war with Hitler because it had become necessary to guarantee Poland's integrity, and that went when Hitler invaded. And I think all of that would have occurred anyway.
But at this point, with the defeat in France...
At this point, it would have been very different, I think. I
mean,
presumably,
yielded,
at this
yeah.
point, there being no Churchill around, Halifax would have taken over,
mm-hmm.
and I suppose it's a fair bet that there would have been a negotiated peace. But what would have happened after that, it's hard to know, because, of course, the case against the negotiated peace was that the record of the previous 5 years showed that Hitler could not be trusted, and therefore a negotiated peace would be worthless.
There's a fellow in your profession knocking about England. I forget his name. Is it Charnley or Charnley? Or
John Charmley.
Charmley, who argues that, Churchill was the worst thing that could have happened to England. England should have yielded to Hitler and should never have gone to war and shouldn't have stayed in the war when they did. I will look for your response to Mr. Charnley after we pause for these words. And so what about the view that Charnley represents? Not so much the man himself, but rather the view that Churchill ultimately may have done Britain some considerable harm by forcing them to stay in that war. After all, the dissolution of the British Empire came as a consequence of the expenditure and the exhaustion that they incurred by waging that war to victory.
Well, it's certainly true that there is a view in some right-wing circles. It was a view that Alan Clark was rather drawn to, and a view that David Irving is very drawn to, as well as John Charmley. that the whole of the Second World War, as managed by Churchill, was a complete disaster for Britain, that Churchill was on this ego trip of wanting to encounter destiny, and totally lost sight of the fact that the more his glory went up, the more Britain's position went down. And this view depends on the presumption that there could and should have been a negotiated peace with Hitler in the summer of 1940, and everything would then have been okay. Hitler could have romped and rampaged around Europe, but that wouldn't have bothered Britain. Britain would have kept its empire. The welfare state would never have happened, Britain would never have become dependent on the United States, and everything would have been fine.
Of course, Hitler would have also gone forward to kill all the rest of the Jews that he hadn't yet killed, and to kill even more Soviet soldiers, and probably to thin out the population of Poland and the Ukraine, as he had already begun to do.
That's right. It seems to me this is a completely phony piece of counterfactual history. I don't think any of the arguments really stand up in detail. Hitler had to be stopped. It was a wicked and evil regime. If the price of getting rid of it was the end of Britain as a great power, it seems to me, on the whole, it was a price well paid. I also think that the notion that the British Empire could have survived until our own day is completely incredible. In the second half of the 20th century, all the great European empires crumble, and that's not just because of the Second World War. I think it's because the nationalist wind was already blowing by the 1920s and 30s, and the Second World War simply blew it a bit harder.
And because they brought the potential elites of the countries, of the colonial nations, into modernity and gave them the education and gave them the aspiration to free themselves.
That's right. In setting up an education system in India and in Africa and elsewhere in the empire, as the British did, the result was the creation by the interwar years of a very literate, very well-educated middle-class elite, many of them lawyers, and of course it was those people who provided the leadership in the 20s and 30s and after the Second World War, which ultimately won for their country's independence.
It's worth noting that both Gandhi and Nehru were British-trained lawyers.
That's right. That's right. Well, lawyers too tend to be quite vociferous in politics, in this country perhaps more than any other, but
yes,
in the British Empire too.
Let's track Churchill just a bit further. After I point out once again that your essays on him and on the various other people that I mentioned earlier are to be found in an excellent new book. I've had tremendous pleasure reading this new book by David Cannadine, In Churchill's Shadow, Confronting the Past in Modern Britain. That's published by Oxford University Press, but I hasten to add it's in their trade division, which is to say it's meant as a book for the laity, and indeed anyone who picks it up will have a tremendous pleasure and also pile up many increments of additional knowledge in the reading thereof. Of this book, The Spectator, one of the leading British journals, says, "The achievement of this elegantly written book is its author's examination of the relationship between culture, in its broadest sense, and politics in an age of decline, a sensitive and imaginative work." The Sunday Telegraph, my favorite British newspaper, as a matter of fact, says, "Lucid, finely written, and accessible, Cannadine has an unerring eye for symbolic details." All true. Very true.
I can neither confirm nor deny that, but it's nice to have it on the dust jacket.
Now, let's go back to our the central figure of our conversation, namely Churchill. Let me see. The end of the war in Europe, that's worth listening to, is it not?
I think it is.
He's telling the British Empire, certainly telling the UK and the world, really, that the war has been won.
"Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Force and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command. General Beadle Smith, Chief of Staff of the United States Army, and General François Sévèze signed the document on behalf of the Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force. And General Suslo Parov signed on behalf of the Russian High Command. Today, this agreement will be ratified and confirmed at Berlin. where Air Chief Marshal Tedder, Deputy Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force, and General de Lattre de Tassigny will sign on behalf of General Eisenhower. General Zhukov will sign on behalf of the Soviet High Command. The German representatives will be Field Marshal Keitel, Chief of the High Command, and the Commandant-in-Chief of the German Army, Navy, and Air Forces. Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight.
It's rather a laundry list of the signatories.
Yes, I think actually we've missed the most important flourish. I think, doesn't it end by saying the German war is therefore at an end, the evildoers lie prostrate before us, advance Britannia, long live the cause of freedom, God save the king.
But the Japanese war still remained
still
to be completed.
Remained to be completed, and of course was not completed until Churchill had been thrown out by the British electorate in the general election of that summer.
Yes, thrown out in the middle of the Potsdam Conference,
that's
as
right.
I remember it.
Well, the election had taken some place some time before that, but because so many of the votes had
the
come in overseas,
votes, yeah.
It took a long time, and it actually came at Potsdam. And there's a marvellous cartoon done by David Lowe, the British cartoonist, about Churchill in the aftermath of that defeat, and it's called The Two Churchills.
Mm-hmm.
And the one Churchill is Churchill, the leader of humanity, sitting on the top of a large podium, winning the plaudits of the world, whose liberty and freedom and honour he saved, and the other is the disgruntled party politician who had waged a very silly campaign in the general election, looking very unhappy and rejected by the electorate. And Churchill, the leader of humanity, looks down serenely at Churchill, the disgruntled party leader, and says, "Cheer up, they will soon forget you, but they will remember me always."
Uh-huh.
It's a rather wonderful cartoon. Of course, my view is that one certainly should not forget Churchill, the leader of humanity, but as a historian, we need to know about the other Churchill as well.
It's worth, of course, reminding our listeners as well, some may have forgotten this or may not know it, that though he was handed his hat, so to speak, by the British public in 1945, he returned some 5 years later for another term as Prime Minister.
That's right. He was Prime Minister again from 1951 to 1955, much more hard going for him then. He was in his late 70s. He wasn't as well. And of course, everybody expected miracles like 1940, but it wasn't that world anymore, and he had a much harder time of things, though there were still some great occasions and, of course, some great speeches too.
We will return to the narrative line that we have developed and look at some other interesting figures who do show up in interesting essays, important essays, in David Cannadine's new book, In Churchill's Shadow. First, we pause for these words. And we return to conversation with David Cannadine, drawing from his utterly enthralling new book, engrossing new book, In Churchill's Shadow, Confronting the Past in Modern Britain, that is just published by Oxford University Press, just published in this country, I should say.
That's right.
It's already been published in the UK.
It came out in the UK in the autumn.
It's time for a musical interlude, but chosen not at random, rather because this particular song from Pinafore well illustrates what you say about Gilbert and Sullivan. You've got a whole chapter on Gilbert and Sullivan in this volume. Why?
Well, there are several explanations. One is that I was born in 1950, and in the early 1960s, Gilbert and Sullivan had come out of copyright. And if you were, as I was, at an all-male boys grammar school in Birmingham, one of the things that all male grammar schools did in the 1960s was productions of Gilbert and Sullivan, and young boys, as I then was, dressed up in ladies' clothes and sang as ladies of the chorus. And so I was a lady of the chorus in The Pirates of Penzance at my school in Birmingham in the early 1960s, and you could say I've never got over that, and so I have always found Gilbert and Sullivan as a result a source of endless fascination. The less personal explanation is that they are, it seems to me, one of these strange British traditions invented in the late 19th century, which endured almost unchanged at the hands of the Doyle Carte Opera Company until the 1950s, and I was interested in working out how Gilbert and Sullivan did it when the operas first came out, and how and why it was they survived in that way for so long, and that seems to me a rather interesting subject.
And you do see them as resonating to the English vision of empire and moral obligation incurred by the maintenance of empire.
That's right. I mean, Gilbert was a very clever and, in certain circumstances, extremely savage satirist. And, of course, lots of things are sent up In the Gilbert and Sullivan operas, the Navy...
Sent up as an English way of saying are satirised.
Satirised, criticised, laughed at.
Yeah.
Certainly the Navy, the police, the monarchy on occasions as well. But of course it's all good-humoured fun. That is to say, there's a presumption that the British can send themselves up or the English can send themselves up, but woe betide anybody else who tries. And underneath the occasionally, but not very often, barbed observations, Sullivan, of course, put what is on the whole rather splendid and stately music. And that made it all seem even more comforting and safe. And that's why people liked it.
Let's hear a snatch. This is from Pinafore when Ralph Rakestraw, is that the way you pronounce his name? Confesses that he is indeed enamored of, and she of him, Josephine, the ward of Sir Joseph Porter KCV, the first Lord of the Admiralty.
That's right.
Though he has no right to aspire so high.
That's right.
But then he notes that despite all of that, he has one thing going for him. He is an English man.
Here, humble, good and lowly born, the meanest in the court division, the doctor of all naked scorn, the mark of Porter Gentilition, have dared to raise with worthy eyes above the dust to men so moaning in Paris' glorious eyes.
Wonderful stuff.
Well, it's quintessential Gilbert and Sullivan. I mean, one could imagine this all being done tongue-in-cheek, and perhaps it is, but of course that rather lovely Handelian music that Sullivan puts underneath it makes it all sound, as it were, the real thing, and I'm sure everybody went away feeling very proud to be English and thinking quite rightly that all foreigners were faintly quaint and comical and that the English were better than anybody else, and
yes,
they had every right to tease themselves just a little bit, which is what the Gilbert and Sullivan operas did.
He might have been a Russian, a Frenchman, or a Prussian.
Or perhaps Italian.
Or perhaps Italian. The intended the mispronunciation is obviously intended.
And, of course, it's picked up later by Churchill when pronouncing German names, as we've already heard.
Yes, we heard him say Jodl.
Jodl.
When that was General Jodl.
That's right. There is
but he didn't mispronounce de lettre Tassigny. Better with the French.
Churchill was quite proud of his French, but there is a speech that he makes after the Second World War to the French in English where he says, I am no longer speaking to you in French. That was in wartime and emergency measures were required, or something like that.
Would you like to hear another from the same? Because it's quite interesting. Sir Joseph Porter sings about how he rose to be First Lord of the Admiralty. And this is, again, a comment on the British class structure and upon the presence of arrivistes, people who are self-made and propel themselves upward in the social system. Are Gilbert and Sullivan offering this as a kind of commentary about the new fluidity in British society.
Gilbert was very interested in the whole issue of social mobility and rank and in established position and in established positions potentially being undermined. That's right. And of course the whole point of the Pirates of Penzance is that all the positions are subverted by the end of the story.
Yes.
And the people at the top turn out to be the people at the bottom.
The pirates turn out to be lords.
That's right. That everything is topsy-turvy. And of course Sir Joseph Porter is actually modelled on a real figure, a Conservative cabinet minister called W.H. Smith, as in the bookstores that you can still find on all British railway stations. And Sir Joseph Porter is a send-up of W.H. Smith, a self-made tradesman.
Let's hear it.
When I was a lad, I served a term as office boy for a tailor's firm. I cleaned the windows and I swept the floor, and I polished up the handle of the big front door. As office boy, I made such a mark in the game for the post of a junior clerk. I served the writs with a smile so bland, and I copied all the letters in a big round hand. I copied all the letters in a hand so free that now I am the ruler of the Queen's Navy. Serving boots, I made such a name with an article clerk I soon became. I wore clean collars and a brand new suit for the bus examination at the Institute. Bus examination, it's a well for me that now I am the ruler of the Queen's Navy. Of legal knowledge, I acquired such a grip that they took me into the partnership. And that junior partnership, I mean, was the only ship that I ever had seen. That kind of ship so suited me that now I am the ruler of the Queen's Navy. I grew so rich that I was sent by a puppet brother into Parliament. I always voted at my party's ball, and I never thought of thinking for myself at all. I thought so little they rewarded me by making me the ruler of the Queen's Navy. Now, landsman all, whoever you may be, if you want to rise to the top of the tree, if your soul isn't fitted to an office stool, be careful to be guided by this golden rule. Stick close to your posts and never go to sea. And you all may be rulers of the Queen's Navy.
What thoughts does that bring to mind about Britain as it is constituted today?
I'm not sure it brings many. I suppose the thought that it brings to mind about that sort of song is that it's hard to imagine what the contemporary equivalent of that would be. I suppose it would be something like Monty Python set to music by Andrew Lloyd Webber. That's about as close an imaginative version of Gilbert and Sullivan in our own time as it would be possible to create.
Now, the reference to Monty Python is fascinating. I've loved the Monty Python stuff. One or two of the Pythons have been on this program, in fact. And they certainly are also engaged in send-up all the time,
That's
the
right.
British class system, of the aristocracy,
right.
of just about everything.
That's right.
And also, they're sending up or sending down the British working class.
I think that's right. I mean, it's a much more savage form of satire and sending up, I suppose, than Gilbert's, which in retrospect is pretty tame. I mean, that song we've just heard, it's sort of funny, but it's pretty undemanding in terms of what it's saying. But by the standards of the time, of course, it was thought to be quite radical. So if one wanted to think of what the equivalent to Gilbert would be today, I think one would have to think of something like Monty Python.
When Wellington beat Bonaparte, how does that go? From Iolanthe.
The House of Lords, the House of Peers throughout the war did nothing in particular and did it very well.
It did it very
that's
well.
The famous phrase in there. Yeah. But again, it's worth noticing that's a slight...
Yeah, Britain won her proudest praise in Good Queen...
In Good King George's Golden
Good
Days.
Good King George's Glorious Days.
That's right. Now, that's a slightly satirical song about the House of Lords, but again, it's worth noticing it's set to a marvellously stately and majestic tune by Sullivan, which entirely undercuts the subversive element of the words, and that's one of the ways in which Gilbert and Sullivan were so extraordinary, that the words are often sending out one message and the music is actually sending out another message.
I've long been interested in, and indeed in my youth even did some writing on, the way in which pop theater culture, the narrative entertainments, whether musical or straight drama, or for that matter very popular novels, the way in which they reflect the problems of the time, the character of the time, the nature of the continuing civilization. What is there in British popular culture these days that clues us as to what's going on?
I'm not sure I know enough about British popular culture to tell you, I'm afraid. I'm not sure I'd be very good at coming up with an answer to that. I'm very struck, looking back on it, that this doesn't answer the question. For now, if you want to understand what's going on in Britain in the 60s, then you could look at and listen to the records of the Beatles, and that will tell you quite a lot about what was going on and would be, I think, a pretty good guide. I suppose it could be said that the Spice Girls were quite a good guide to what's going on in British culture, or now posh Spice, Mrs. Victoria Beckham, as she now is, married to the soccer player David Beckham. They are Britain's most famous celebrity couple, and that might tell you quite a bit about what's going on, that celebrity is an important part of British life, more so than it's ever been, that soccer is a very important part of British life. Well, it always has been, but a lot of new Labour government ministers think soccer's very important. So that will be one way into getting some sense of what's going on in British life at the moment.
As an occasional visitor to the UK over a long time, and as an avid consumer of British literature, all the way from the 18th century to the present, and as a social science type who is aware of these statistical studies and follows them with some interest, I have a sense that, and it's hardly a unique perception of mine, that there are some very significant changes going on right now, and some social disorganization is growing ever more visible in British life, if only as indexed by, say, crime rates.
Well, there are certainly a lot of
changes. And by social conflict between groups on the ground, as it were.
There certainly are a lot of changes going on at the moment, not all of them ones that can be applauded. Certainly the rising crime rate is one of those. But I think it's worth noticing that, for example, the number of young people getting university education has dramatically increased in the 1980s and 1990s, and on the whole that seems to be a good thing. I think an educated citizenry is better than a non-educated citizenry. And it's also the case, although we only hear the often, I admit, terrible stories to the contrary, that multicultural Britain is actually more of a success story than we're often told about. There is a case to be made for saying at the moment that London is actually one of the most successful multicultural cities in the world, in terms, for example, of the number of foreign languages spoken. Apparently, London overtook New York as the world's most multicultural city in the last year or two. So although there certainly are problems, there are problems with crime, there are problems with health care provision, there are problems with education, there are problems with transport, in other ways I think things are actually looking rather good. So I suppose it's business as usual, really.
Well, that's nice to hear. So it's your personal sense as a Brit living right in the middle of it all and knowing the full range of British history, that the disorganization that followed up with the loss of empire and economic problems that came with that as well, that you're sort of through those woods and you've entered into a new sunlit upland?
Well, I don't know that it's a sunlit upland. It's probably a rainy upland since it's Britain, but that's probably all right. But I think it is true to say that although by various criteria, if one thinks of the size of the navy, as in Sir Joseph Porter, or the size of the empire, or Britain's ranking as the first industrial nation, all of which could still roughly be said to be true around 1900, all that's gone 100 years later. And that's real decline, and that still causes some people much distress. But it has to be said, in terms of quality of life, length of life, education, security, income, the average British person today is unbelievably much better off than their forebear 100 years ago. And it seems to me that that's all to the good.
So you're rather glad to be back.
Well, I'm rather glad to be living in Britain in 2003 than in 1903, yeah. Though it would have been rather fun to have been at the first performance of Land of Hope and Glory, I suppose.
But you did live in New York for 10 years. How do you contrast, not New York and London, but American contemporary life and British contemporary life?
Well, I did, as you say, live in New York for 10 years and absolutely loved it. I taught at Columbia, and it was in a period when New York was, I think, doing rather well. And I still like coming back and forth across the Atlantic, since they're both marvellous countries, and I think the more time you spend in one, the more you become attuned to the oddities of the other, and that seems to me a rather interesting way to think about things. And I'm very struck by the fact that if you look at Britain from here, it seems very bizarre and extraordinary. The monarchy, which everybody in Britain still takes for granted, seems strange and needs explaining, and lots of other things do as well. And I regard part of my job as a historian to help try to explain those things. By the same token, if you look at America from over there, one of the things, of course, that strikes British people is that America is now the last great superpower, and arguably, indeed, America is the only really successful imperial power. But lots of Americans don't want to be told that, because they think that this was a nation conceived in opposition to empire, throwing out the British in 1776, and a nation that still disapproves of empire. And they find it a rather uncomfortable contradiction in America's history and present condition that a nation conceived in opposition to one empire is arguably now the last empire left. And that seems to me a British perspective on America that it's actually quite useful to come to America to put across.
The American response on the part of some strategic theory types and political types who are invested in foreign relations planning and so on is essentially the plaintive cry, someone's got to do it.
Yes, and I'm not necessarily denying that that's true. And of course the other reply is, well, it may be true that America is an empire in that its culture dominates the world, the dollar dominates the world, and the American Navy and Army dominate the world. But unlike the British Empire, of course, apart from North America, the rest of the world is not painted with the stars and the stripes. I mean, America is arguably an imperial power, but there is no formal empire. Although I suppose there may be an extension into Iraq in the next month or so, depending on what happens.
What happens immediately is we pause for some commercials. And some interesting clips still waiting to be played. But it is time to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines right now. The number, of course, is 591-7200. 591-7200. And questions and comments and thoughts are more than welcome. In fact, if there are any resident Brits listening, we'd love to hear from you. And for that matter, if Brits are listening in the UK at the moment on the internet, if you're up that early, do by all means give us not so much a call, but rather email the email address, extension 720@tribune.com. Or 591-7200. We return after these words. We will be on to the phones shortly, but we can't abandon our various little recordings without taking care of one or two other things. We have here, and I've not heard this, Barry, our producer, has dug this up. I don't think I've ever heard Churchill on his 80th birthday. What can you tell us about these comments by Churchill?
This is a very extraordinary speech. It's the last publicly recorded speech, I think, that Churchill made while Prime Minister. And on his 80th birthday, there was a huge ceremony in Westminster Hall in the Houses of Parliament when Churchill received lavish praise from virtually everybody in British public life. It was a wholly unprecedented occasion in British public life, and it will never, I suspect, ever happen again.
This is in what year, then?
This is in November 1954,
yeah.
And he resigned as Prime Minister the following spring. And it was, I think, an occasion wholly without precedent in British public life. In the first place, there hadn't been a Prime Minister at the age of 80 since Gladstone or Palmerston. And secondly, this was an all-party motion congratulating him on his birthday. It's impossible to imagine that that could happen now.
Here it is.
I have never accepted what many people have kindly said, namely that I inspired the nation. Their will was resolute and remorseless, and yet it proved unconquerable. It fell to me to express it, and if I found the right words, you must remember that I have always earned my living by my pen and by my tongue. It was the nation and the race dwelling all round the globe that had the lion heart. I had the luck to be called upon to give the roar. I also hope that I sometimes suggested to the lion the right places to use his claws.
Take him all in all, he was a man. We shall not look upon his like again.
I think that's right. That's a very characteristic late Churchill speech. Yeah. It's much less aggressive, much less defiant, much less combative than the speeches in the Second World War.
It still has wonderful form.
But it still has wonderful form. And, of course, it's utterly implausible. I mean, it's a marvellous piece of self-deprecation. But the notion of Churchill claiming that he didn't do much in 1940, well, only he could say it and get away with it.
I want to offer you one other former prime minister. When she, and that tells you who it was on this program just a few years ago. After we hear from Lady Thatcher, I'd like to get your comments on her regime and on contemporary British politics, which we're very interested in these days, because there is the question of whether the current prime minister is getting himself into deep trouble by going along with our president.
There is indeed.
Apparently we don't have it set up yet, but we do have some commercials that are waiting anyway. We'll take care of those, and then we'll go to Margaret Thatcher, who returns with some chagrin, because I've been informed by my friends in the control booth that the attempt to put Margaret Thatcher on the proper disc so we could play her tonight didn't work, and that's because of some trouble with some system or other. I never understand these things. They do. However, I can say to all who are listening that you can get Margaret Thatcher on our website. That is, if you go to WGNradio.com and then go to our subsite for extension 720, you'll find a number of things, including the audio archive. And if you search for her on the audio archive, you'll find an excerpt, at least, from one of her two appearances on this program. But we won't have the voice of Margaret Thatcher. Instead, we have a quote.
Yes, well, you should be congratulated, Milt, in certain quarters, on having succeeded in doing what many politicians failed to do in the 1980s, and they were desperate to do it, which is shutting Margaret Thatcher up. congratulations on that. Anyway, here's a quotation that I happen to have come across at random. This is Thatcher in the 1979 election campaign, the winter of discontent and all that, when it did seem as though Britain was in extremis. And this is what Thatcher said, among other things: unless we change our ways and our direction, our glories as a nation will soon be a footnote in the history books, a distant memory of an offshore island lost in the mists of time, like Camelot remembered kindly for its noble past.
Well,
that's
well
quite
praised.
Eloquent stuff, yeah, isn't it? Yeah. Yes.
Must have been written for by our mutual friend Geoffrey Archer.
I think it must have been. Probably edited by somebody so they got the commas in the right places. Mm-hmm. But this, of course, was what Thatcher, in a sense, made her reputation on and won the 1979 election on, that Britain was a nation in what seemed to be terminal decline, racked by socialism, strikes, trade unions, an incompetent Labour government and all the rest of it, and she was going to stop that decline and make things better.
And she represented the same thing that in this country was represented by Ronald Reagan. Indeed, she speaks very fondly of him and felt herself in continuing partnership with him. Their terms overlapped considerably.
That's right. I think Reagan and Thatcher saw themselves as the greatest partnership in the special relationship since Churchill and Roosevelt, and I think they were both very much aware of that historical precedent.
A word from you, if I may seek it. I may seek it. I'm sure you will offer it as well. The current political situation. I get a sense that the backbenchers in the Labour Party, and maybe even some of the middle and front benchers, are really revolting, and that Blair has painted himself into a very difficult situation.
It's not clear how things are going to play out. Blair has been steadfast in his support of both the United Nations and the United States. If it comes to the point where the United States go for Iraq without further UN approval, and if under those circumstances Blair goes in with Bush, I think he will face serious trouble in his own party from his backbenchers and from some of his cabinet. And I think he may well find that public opinion in general won't support it. And that would put him in a very difficult position.
But he will remain steadfast, do you think? Despite that trouble on his own flank.
My guess is that he will. He is fairly strong-willed in matters of foreign affairs, as we saw over Kosovo, and my guess is that having, as I think he has, pledged his support to Bush, he'll probably stand by him.
It is time to go to the telephones. If you'll put on that headset, and I should have told you the control knob is below the table on your left, and we will take some calls on 591-7200. 591-7200. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Doctor and Dave. You mentioned that Churchill did some drinking, but we also know that Churchill said that he was plagued by a black dog of, I guess, depression. And so my question is, and it's hard to know the answer, do you think he did the drinking to relieve his depression, or do you think his drinking caused his depression? I know from personal experience that my daughter drank to relieve her depression, so I know it can go either way, and I just wondered if you had any guess on that.
It's a good question, that, I think, because drinking and depression were indeed two of Churchill's characteristics. I don't quite know that there was a very close connection. It's important to remember that Churchill grew up in the late 19th and early 20th century, when almost all figures in public life were hard-drinking and hard-eating figures, and Churchill perpetuated, in a sense, of an Edwardian scale of consumption of both food and wine well on into the second half of the 20th century. But you're right to say that one of the things that Churchill suffered from was what he called the black dog, that is, depression. And one of the reasons I think that he was so hyperactive, both as a public figure, as a writer, and ultimately I think as a painter, was that he sought in activity rather than in drink a way of keeping the black dog at bay. And it's very interesting that he took up painting in the First World War after he'd been hounded out of office because of his disgrace and discrediting over the Dardanelles campaign, and he was so depressed he couldn't think of anything else to do, and he found a box of paints and started painting. So I think one of the ways of understanding Churchill's astonishingly creative and energetic and productive life across a whole range of human activities was that this was a whole set of resources that he mobilised to keep depression at bay. And I don't think, on the whole, that taking in alcohol was part of that strategy. I think he took in alcohol because it's what you did if you were a member of the upper classes born in the late 19th century.
You rely in a number of your chapters on Churchill on the memoirs, I guess, of Lord Moran.
Yes, they're a very controversial source. Lord Moran was, of course, Churchill's doctor from the Second World War until Churchill's death in 1965, and he kept a diary. Mm-hmm. Whether he kept the diary at the time or whether he wrote it up later is a source of much controversy and debate, and I don't know enough about the scholarly details to have a particularly well-informed view. One view of Moran is that he just doesn't understand, that he only sees Churchill when he's ill, so he gives a wholly distorted picture of what Churchill in the round was really like. And depicts him as a failing, enfeebled old man all the time, when, as some of these speeches that you've played suggest, even unto his 80s, he was actually on occasions very vigorous. But while all that is true, I think Moran was very perceptive about some things. He was very perceptive about Churchill's courage. He was very perceptive about Churchill's oratory. He was very perceptive about Churchill's sense of history. And I think a lot of what Moran wrote is worth taking note of. What, of course, caused enormous offence was that Moran published those diaries very soon after Churchill's death, while Churchill's widow was still alive. And that made a lot of people very angry.
Our phone number, 591-7200. There's room on the board for additional calls now. If you've been trying to reach us, do certainly try again. And there's infinite, or almost infinite, whatever that means, capacity on the email. The email address being extension 720, one word, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com. Extension 720 at Tribune.com, or 591-7200. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
I had a question in regard to the reasons that Churchill supported the abdication of Edward VIII. I believe it's been fairly well established that British intelligence had determined that Edward VIII was cooperating with Hitler and would pursue a pro-German policy. And for that reason, Churchill and other leaders of the British government facilitated his abdication and more or less forced him to abdicate.
Oh, your thesis is that Churchill's motivation was, let's get this guy off the throne. He's bad for our future when we have to face Hitler.
Yes, and that, as I understand it, after Edward VIII abdicated and became the Duke of Windsor, he was essentially exiled to the Bahamas to get him entirely out of the arena.
He was made Governor General of the Bahamas, I believe.
He wanted to get him as far away from the political situation as possible.
David?
Well, I think you've got some wires crossed here. Churchill, of course, didn't want Edward VIII to abdicate. He wanted him to stay in power. It was members of the government who were more in favour of him going. And Churchill was, of course, not a member of the government at the time of the abdication. As for his Nazi sympathies, this is quite a tricky issue. It's clearly the case that later on, Hitler thought that if he successfully invaded Britain, the Duke of Windsor might be an appropriate puppet monarch instead of George VI. And it's certainly the case that after the abdication, the Windsors visited Germany in a rather ill-advised and much-publicised tour. And it's also the case that the Duke of Windsor was not a very bright man and was easily taken in by people like prominent Nazis like Ribbentrop, who was the Nazi ambassador in London. But whether he actually would have been a traitor, I don't know, and we shall never know. The real reason he was sent to the Bahamas was because George VI and his wife, Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, who died recently, absolutely would not have him back in Britain. They would not receive him. And Churchill had to find somewhere to put him. And because he wasn't very bright, he couldn't really be trusted to do a big job. There was almost nowhere you could send him except the Bahamas, where they hoped he'd be out of harm's way, though in fact he got into lots of trouble there as well.
During the war, didn't he agitate to get a field commission of some kind?
Yes, he wanted all sorts of jobs. He wanted to be ambassador to Washington. He wanted to be a roving ambassador in North America. He wanted a major military command, and Churchill, quite reasonably, I think, took the view that this was a risk he wasn't willing to run. Churchill was in quite a difficult position here. He did like the Duke of Windsor personally. He felt he'd been badly treated at the time of the abdication, but there was nothing he could do to help him in the Second World War except send him to the Bahamas.
Our thanks to the caller. We pause for a last round of commercial messages and then directly back to David Cannadine for your questions and comments to him as we continue to draw from his new book, In Churchill's Shadow, that's published by Oxford University Press. And we return to David Cannadine. Here's an email that will interest you. This fellow says, thanks for the great history shows this month. We've had a number of historians here because the AHA
right.
was meeting in Chicago. I'm one of Professor Cannadine's former students at Columbia and have a very broad question. I should tell you, this man is Joe Eaton, emailing from Oklahoma City. And his broad question is, what are some criteria that a historian should consider when choosing a subject to write on? Warm regards, Joe Eaton, Oklahoma City. Ordinarily, we don't give the names, but since he's a former student of yours, I've made an exception.
Well, yes, it's very nice to hear from you, Joe, if you're actually listening in. I do, of course, remember you, and I remember you were rather bright, and I see further evidence of that since this is rather a good and difficult question, though I suppose I ought to be able to answer it. Lots of things that drive one to choose the subjects to write on. Curiosity, just wanting to know whether it will be fun or not. Whether it's important or not, whether it has contemporary relevance or not, whether you think you can tell a story or make it work. I suppose there's a whole variety of things, and it's fair to say that to the extent that I've written on monarchy and class and empire and Churchill, I think all of those would come under most of those criteria or would satisfy most of those criteria.
You've just told me that the book you're now working on is a biography of Andrew Mellon.
That's right. I've spent most of my life writing about monarchs and aristocrats who are very good at spending money, and I thought it was time I wrote about somebody who was good at making money, which would be rather a different way to look at things.
But to go with the same question, how did you choose him rather than some other figure if you're doing a biographical study?
Well, actually, I was chosen to do it. That is to say that the Andrew Mellon Foundation, on which Andrew's son Paul was a trustee for many years, decided that Andrew Mellon, who is a major figure in American history in the second half of the 19th century and the first third of the 20th century, needed a proper biography. And for reasons that I don't understand, they decided that I was the person to do it, and they asked me to do it, and I agreed to do so because it seemed to me a marvellous challenge and opportunity to do an American subject rather than a British one, and as I say, to write about somebody who was a genius at making money, whereas most of the people I've written about were just very good at spending it.
Yeah, well, politicians do that.
Yes, but Andrew, of course, made a huge amount of money. He had an amazing array
Though
of
he was
careers.
Also the American Secretary of the Treasury for
That's
a while.
That's right. He was a very successful Pittsburgh banker. He was Secretary of the Treasury. He was the greatest art collector of his generation, and he founded the National Gallery.
And we go back to the phones. Here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I was wondering if Churchill had a strategy for bringing America into the war, and if so, if it included any kind of a collusion with Roosevelt to accomplish this.
Well, it's absolutely clear that from the very beginning, when he was Prime Minister, Churchill knew that although victory at all costs was what he wanted, the likelihood of achieving that without some serious Allied support wasn't very high. So he certainly wanted to get America in, and of course the speeches from 1940 on are full of lots of allusions to America.
Give us the tools purpose. And we will finish the job.
That's right. But I don't think there was a strategy. I think all Churchill could do was to encourage Roosevelt to act in a very unneutral way while America was still ostensibly neutral.
But Roosevelt was deeply motivated to do that, even without much urging from Churchill, wasn't he?
I think that's right. I mean, Lend-Lease was as much Roosevelt's idea as it was Churchill's. But, I mean, Churchill just had to, in a sense, wait on events till something happened which persuaded Roosevelt that in the end he had to go to war. Roosevelt was not very eager to go to war. Churchill knew that, and he simply had to wait and hope for the best. So I don't think, in a sense, he did have a strategy beyond that.
One wonders, what would have happened if Hitler, with the Japanese having attacked us at Pearl Harbor, and we then declare war on Japan, but not on Germany,
that's right,
if Hitler had not then declared war on the United States?
I don't know that it bears thinking about, really. I mean, it could all have come out very differently. And, of course, Churchill does have this observation in his memoirs that once Pearl Harbor happens and once Hitler does as he does, then Churchill knew that Britain would in the end win. And it's the piece of news that he most needed.
Back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening. The first Gilbert and Sullivan clip brought to mind the names of any number of Englishmen in the 100 years before Churchill became Prime Minister who were really mega figures in their fields. I could rattle off Sir William Howard Russell, Sir Edward Henry, Lord Rutherford, James Chadwick, Bertrand Russell, G.E. Moore. I could go on and on. And it just seems to me as though, from what I can tell anyway, such people's contributions are virtually unknown in the States other than to specialists. And while that is, I suppose, fairly common, in other words, the Russians will tend to think that everything of importance came from Russia and so on, does it grate at all among Englishmen that such massive contributions are so not well known here, particularly given the fact that we have a common language and the fact that the USA is so powerful? It's got this so-called empire and it's got the weapons of mass destruction and all of that.
Well, I think it's interesting you should name some of those names like Chadwick and Rutherford and Russell, who were, of course, many of them Churchill's contemporaries and in their own time great figures in a whole variety of fields. You say, am I dismayed, they haven't been heard of in America. I say to you in reply that they haven't much these days been heard of in Britain. If you walked up and down a main street in the centre of London and said, who was Rutherford or who was Bertrand Russell, I fear not many people would know. So I think to the extent that they aren't known here, it causes me no more dismay than it does that they aren't heard of there.
What if you walked across the common, one of the colleges at Cambridge, and asked who Bertrand Russell was? Would they know?
I think it would depend which college it was, but I think in certain cases they probably would.
I would hope so. 591-7200, and again to the phones. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. Great show. Listen, this goes back a little bit further, but I was wondering. I saw a movie called Lawrence After Arabia, and in the postscript, it said that Lawrence and Churchill helped establish Prince Faisal as the first king of what is now called Iraq. After he declared himself, Faisal declared himself king of Syria and then was kicked out by the French in 1920, he and Churchill apparently helped establish Faisal as the first king of Iraq. Churchill's role in that. Thank you very much.
Yes, that's absolutely right. When the map of the Middle East is redrawn after the end of the First World War and the Turkish Empire ends, and as we were talking about earlier, Britain gets these two League of Nations mandates in Jordan and Iraq. Churchill is colonial secretary at that time, and there's a conference in Cairo where Lawrence is his chief advisor, and Churchill decides that what both of those countries have got to have is monarchies, and so there is a Hashemite monarchy established in Jordan, and one is established, which is still there to this day, and one was established in Iraq. And for Churchill, establishing monarchies in the aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution seemed to him a very good thing. He thought that monarchy and constitutional monarchy was the best of all possible worlds, and given a chance to create kings, he went ahead and did it. So you're absolutely right.
Here's an interesting email. One of my favorite recent novels and films is Kazuo Ishiguro's The Remains of the Day. As a matter of fact, Ishiguro appeared on this program when he did his next novel. In many ways, a book as much about the decline of Britain as about the personal failings and deep regrets of the English butler, Stevens. Does David Cannadine agree that the book aptly captures the mournful mood of British decline, or has Ishiguro greatly overstated things?
Well, it is a good film, of course. It's sort of Gosford Park without the whodunit, isn't it? I mean, both of those are set at almost the same time. And both of them, I think, do convey this impression in the 30s of a slightly decadent and exhausted, I mean, decadent in an exhausted rather than, as it were, profligate sense of British politics and British country house life. I think we have to be careful. It's rather like all these films like The Shooting Party on the eve of the First World War, that in retrospect we know that the deluge was about to happen, and so we assume that just before that everything must have been looking rather tired, let's put it that way. I don't know how far that really was true in the 1930s. I think Neville Chamberlain thought he'd fix things with Hitler and everything would be all right. Churchill, I'm sure, was worried, did think things were in a bad way. But then Churchill didn't go around country houses in a remains of the day sort of way. So I think it's a marvellous book and a marvellous film, but I think it's a bit too retrospectively knowing, and it doesn't quite capture how things were, although I do think it's a great read and a great view.
Another email, a little bit longer, but let me... go through this one. You talked about where things might have stood in 1940 had Churchill been killed by that automobile accident in New York. You suggested that Halifax might have asked Hitler for a negotiated settlement. Along those lines, is there any substance to the recent reports that Wallis Simpson was a Nazi sympathizer and possibly a Nazi agent through her relationship with Hitler's foreign minister, Herr von Ribbentrop? In the light of those regrets, what do you think, those reports, what do you think might have happened in 1939 or 1940 with respect to the war with Germany had King Edward VIII been allowed to retain the throne while marrying Mrs. Simpson? We've touched on this, but not earlier, but not upon Mrs. Simpson's influence and her favoring the Nazis by virtue of some connection with von Ribbentrop.
Yes, it's another good what-if question. In fact, I once appeared on a radio program in Britain on exactly this question, what if Edward hadn't abdicated and had been allowed to marry Wallis Simpson? And I think the conclusion that we reached then, and it's one that I'd still adhere to now, I think, was that whatever his private views were and whatever her private views were, I think they would have carried much less weight than either they themselves may have thought or than Hitler and his friends may have thought, and that probably in the end, Edward VIII would have been much less of a kind of fifth columnist and a potentially traitorous presence as king than we might fancifully suppose. But on the whole, I'm glad he did abdicate, but I don't think if he hadn't, he would have been quite the problem people sometimes now think he might have been.
The chapters of this book are essays that originally were done separately.
That's right.
As major articles, but they do weave together in a very fascinating way. And you've got chapters on two... men of the narrative entertainments, one might say, namely Noel Coward. Well, he's also a composer. He writes wonderful popular music of a sort,
right.
And he does plays and films. And then we've got Ian Fleming. Now, how do you bring them into the general realm that we are wandering in tonight, or negotiating tonight, which is, after all, about alteration in the nature of British culture and civilization as the historic role of Britain is transformed to a lesser status than was once the case?
Well, very much that one can see in their work exactly that set of developments and anxieties being articulated and worked out, though not very happily. Both Coward and Fleming were very much in Churchill's shadow. That's to say, they thought that he was a great man and they thought that his performance in the Second World War and Britain's performance was wonderful. And they both much regretted the decline of Britain in the years after 1945, the erosion of the empire, the welfare state, which they thought was sapping the moral fibre of the nation and so on. And Coward, in his later work, wrote a set of rather escapist musicals and novels all about that, lamenting the demise of British greatness. And it's not coincidence that that was the period when he was much less popular as a writer than he had been in his heyday in the 1920s and 30s. Fleming, on the other hand, excuse me, managed to put a much more positive spin on all this by creating this figure, James Bond, who at one level was a hero straight out of John Buchan, a kind of swashbuckling gent on the frontiers of empire, stopping the end of the world and saving the empire.
John Buchan, Lord Tweedsmuir.
That's right, Governor-General of Canada.
Who was Governor-General of Canada for a while.
That's right.
And the author of the 39 Steps.
And a whole variety of other espionage novels. But what Fleming was also able to do was to make Bond a figure of his time, that's to say a figure who knew all about the right sort of wines to order in restaurants and who drove fast cars, and a figure, of course, who was constantly in bed with different sorts of women. And so he somehow embodied permissive welfare state Britain. And so Fleming was able to make his worry about Britain's decline in the aftermath of Churchill into a commercially very successful enterprise, that's the James Bond novels, whereas Noel Coward actually wasn't. And I was interested in that sense in which they were indeed in Churchill's shadow.
Time is almost gone, but here's somebody about whom you don't have a chapter, but all the same, I wonder, Jean Le Carré.
Well, Le Carré is, of course, post-Fleming. That is to say, in Fleming's books, you can still just about perpetuate the fantasy that Britain is a great power and that the Secret Service is wonderful and everything's okay. By the time we reach Le Carré, the whole show is finished. Spying is no longer glamorous. It's not clear that Britain is in the right. The empire's over. The whole thing is a disaster.
And everybody betrays everybody else.
And everybody betrays everybody else. And it's very miserable. And they never drink champagne.
No, they don't. But some of them do become drunkards all the same.
They do indeed. But Smiley, unlike, whereas Bond beds all the women, Smiley is, of course, a cuckolded husband, so it's much less good.
Oh, dear. We are out of time. It's been a delight having you here. And we're going to put this conversation up on our audio archive to join the one that we have with Ian
Kershaw.
Kershaw, who was here a while ago. You've told me tonight while we were off the air that he's been knighted while ago.
Ian Kershaw is now Sir Ian Kershaw. Yeah. This is one of the few good things that Hitler has ever done, and we should be very grateful for that.
He's done the major biography of Adolf Hitler, a famous two-volume biography, that the second volume of which appeared only last year. We thus come to a close, and I should tell you quickly that tomorrow night we will be talking with Tom Kirkpatrick of the Chicago Crime Commission and John Bulldog Drummond, one of our favorite guests from Channel 2. The topic is, of course, the Chicago crime scene. Thursday night, a visit with the Field Museum and some of the leading researchers over at that very significant institution. For now, time to close down again with thanks to David Cannadine. Thanks to all for listening, and a cordial good night.
Thank you so much.